Ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument, United States v. Shapiro and a number of others, Mr. LaPuma.
May it please the Court. My name is Frank LaPuma, and I represent Joe Lombardo. I'd like to begin the argument this morning with an issue that is common to the appellants. And it's an issue which the government seemingly concedes constituted error in the district court. And that is where Judge Zagel, without notice to the defendants, excused a juror, that would be juror number 14, and came into the courtroom after a lunch break and simply said to defense counsel, "We lost a juror." And the judge proceeded to give an abbreviated background as to what had occurred. Over the later that day, he gave a somewhat more detailed version, and then he, in post-trial motions, he wrote it all out. But basically, it boils down to this. Early on in the trial, one of the jurors, that is juror 14, indicated to the jury administrator, Linda Rudolph, that she felt uncomfortable. And the administrator said, "Well, if you'd like, you could send a letter or a note to the judge." She didn't. And 6 or 7 weeks passed, and the judge indicated on the record that during that period of time, there was absolutely nothing, no indication at all that she wanted to speak to the judge. But what the judge did on his own volition was bring her into his chambers and speak to her directly and find out what the problem was from 6 to 7 weeks that occurred earlier. And in the afternoon session, when the judge was giving the defendants a little bit more background as to what occurred, he indicated, and this is at 5951 of the transcripts, "I was told that in terms of interpersonal relations among the jurors, she did not participate." And, of course, this is while the trial is ongoing. It's not during deliberations.
Mr. LaPuma, can I just ask you, you're not arguing, are you, that this is structural error? It seems to me this is an error that's subject to a form of harmless error review.
Well, Judge, it could be considered structural error, but under our argument, this is subject to harmless error review. This is a Rule 43 violation because, in our view, and I think the government agrees with this, this was a stage of the trial. And in every criminal case, the defendant has the right to be present under Rule 43, and that's rooted in the Sixth Amendment Confrontation Clause and the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause.
But what evidence of prejudice do you have from the dismissal of Juror 14?
Well, let me start by saying, Your Honor, that first of all, we did not get an opportunity to develop prejudice because Judge Zagel dismissed the juror without notice and without giving the defense an opportunity to voir dire her or anybody else on the jury. So we were precluded from having an opportunity to develop prejudice. But I think prejudice is...
When did you find out?
I'm sorry, Judge?
You really want to voir dire her?
Well, Judge, I would if I was trial counsel.
What would you say?
Well, Judge, I'd like to find out what the problem is because one of the points that Judge Zagel says she made, and of course we have to take Judge Zagel at his word, and we do, because no court reporter was present for this communication with the juror. What would we say? She said something about was a threat made against me. And so this threat was something that definitely would raise some concerns in a case where there's 18.
My question, what did you want to ask her?
Well, I would definitely have followed up, Judge, with what is the threat that you're concerned about.
How is that going to help your client? I don't understand.
Well, Judge, if the jurors as a group are talking about threats or feeling threatened from the defendants at the trial where we have an anonymous jury.
You want to voir dire the whole jury and ask them about threats?
Well, Judge, I think that is down the line.
That's a concern. That is down the line.
I think the first step, Judge, would be to interview that particular juror and find out what went wrong. What the impact here, the prejudice here was...
I don't really see how you can have a lawyer for the defendant, or the prosecutor for that matter, interviewing a juror in the middle of the trial.
Well, Judge, now...
She goes back into the jury room and talks to the other juror? I don't get it. I don't see it.
Well, Judge, I submit it. It has been done. I mean, I have been involved in cases where jurors actually were brought in and voir dired by the judge with parties present and with a court reporter.
You want to voir dire them.
I'm sorry, Judge?
You wanted to voir dire them. You
yes.
wanted to question her.
Well, the
or
judge...
Or you wanted the judge. You wanted the procedure you're describing.
Yes, exactly, Judge. And if
you wanted to question her.
Well, no, Judge. I would like Judge Zagel to conduct the questioning
you
and then...
You want to tell him what questions to ask.
If he would allow us additional questions, we would suggest additional questions. That's correct. But he would, of course, lead that questioning, not us. But it did. There was a prejudice here. I mean, the jury was affected.
But let me nail down exactly when you find this out. Because by the time this seems to be discussed, she's gone. And so you would have had to have brought her back in again. And that would have been rather disruptive. So did you find out at the end of the day when she left? She leaves in the middle of the day, right?
Correct, Judge.
So wouldn't you have had an opportunity to object that afternoon?
Well, I believe that what happened was there was a full morning evidentiary session. There was a break for lunch. As everyone was gathering for the afternoon session, Judge Zagel was at the bench, the attorneys were gathered around, and he said, we lost a juror. Now, this is 6 to 7 weeks after this notice was given to Judge Zagel, and plenty of time for him to bring this to the attention of the parties. In fact, he talks about a week earlier he had some contact with the juror. He could have mentioned this to the litigants, but he didn't.
But I thought one of the lawyers, perhaps not you, commented at that point, well, she's an alternate anyway, and I don't want this case to turn into a production about the jury. Is that Mr. Marcello's lawyer?
I believe that was, Judge. I believe Mr. Breen suggested that. But I think that was that Judge Zagel also offered that up, Your Honor, by saying this. She is an alternate at this time. We don't know if she's going to become a Pettit juror. There is a likelihood she won't. And you can reserve your objections until the end of the trial, and you will not have waived anything. And he clearly said that both orally.
Would she have become a juror, a regular juror?
Yes, Judge. In fact, two other jurors were dismissed, two Pettit jurors were dismissed who had engaged in misconduct during the trial when another juror sent a letter to the judge saying these people have prejudged the case, they're telling us we don't have to deliberate too long. And there was a full voir dire then, Judge, on that particular occasion, and two jurors were dismissed with the concurrence of the parties. It is an unusual practice for a judge to enter the jury room, to get into any discussions with them, as this court pointed out in United States versus Smith. And I would add just a little bit further on this. Judge Zagel had far too many contacts with this juror by his own admissions. This is his statement. This is a jury which has one large communal enterprise, and that is jigsaw puzzles. If you go into the jury room, you'll see this gigantic thing laid out on the table in very complex, very large jigsaw puzzles, and they bring new ones in each week, and 6 or 8 of the jurors do that. Whenever I went to the jury room, and I go into the jury room every now and then because I tell them stuff about scheduling. Now, that may seem innocuous, but most of that is done in open court with the parties being present. It's unusual for judges to go into the jury room and do that type of thing. This is not Judge Zagel's jury. It's not the government's jury. It's Mr. Lombardo's jury and Mr. Marcello's jury. And the rest of the appellants in this case, they're the ones who have the right to that jury, the right to an impartial and fair jury, not Judge Zagel. There are other errors that were committed by Judge Zagel related to the jury, and I would turn now to the discussion about Frank Calabrese's death threat to a federal prosecutor. This was done in open court where Mr. Calabrese apparently said, this is what Judge Zagel's finding was, that you're an effing dead man to a prosecutor who's presenting his closing argument on the guilt phase of the trial prior to the penalty phase of the trial. And what Judge Zagel did to try and see if there was one way to correct this was to conduct an abbreviated inquiry of this juror, juror number 46.
I thought this comes out, though, only after the case is over.
It does, Judge. That's correct.
So it comes out then, and I further thought that Judge Zagel, after he looks into it, with the participation of the parties, decides that juror 46, the foreman, is honestly reporting that that was his perception of what was heard in the courtroom.
That was the judge's finding, correct, Judge.
So isn't that a credibility finding to which we owe great deference?
Well, I personally feel that you can give great deference to that, and we would encourage you to accept that finding. I think one of the other appellants, Mr. Calabrese's counsel, may disagree with my position on that. But what we believe additional questioning of that juror was required because Judge Zagel seemed to cut it short, Judge, when he only asked, did you hear anybody talk about this prior to the beginning of deliberations? That was the only question that he asked that really went to the central issue. What would a follow-up question would have been from the defense counsel, as indicated on the record, which they weren't allowed to do, Judge Zagel did release the juror at that time, was this. Did you say anything to any other jurors about what you heard? Just a fundamental question that should have been asked. And it was proposed by the attorneys to Judge Zagel, and Judge Zagel said no.
What difference would it have made?
Well, if it was prior to deliberations, Your Honor, of course we can't get into it because of 606B during deliberations, although there is some argument to indicate that this was an extraneous influence.
If it happens in the courtroom, it's not extraneous.
Well, it's certainly not part of the evidence in the case, Judge. And I would then go to the Manny case, which Judge Posner, I believe, was sitting on that panel, where there was a similar conduct by a co-defendant that disrupted the trial. A little bit different in that case.
Oh, there's a lot different in that case.
Well, I agree. That was Mr.
Extreme.
That was extreme. That certainly was extreme. But I would submit respectfully, Judge, that what occurred here also was extreme because it's not one isolated incident with respect to Frank Calabrese. It's throughout the trial with his strange and odd facial expressions, his grunting, his moaning. It's when he yells out, screams out during closing arguments, those are lies or them are lies. It's when he's talking back to Judge Zagel.
Right, but this gets to the severance issue rather than whether this is improper extraneous information because it's happening right in the courtroom in front of the jury, so it just doesn't qualify as an extraneous influence brought to bear on the jury, whether during the trial or during deliberations.
Well, I would suggest, Judge, and I know each of you...
Well, should he have been removed from the Calabrese? Should he have been removed from the court? Did the lawyers for the other defendants want him removed?
Well, Judge, in a larger sense, the answer is yes. They did want to have a separate trial from him.
I don't understand what a larger sense means. Did they want him expelled from the courtroom?
If you're...
When people act, when parties, when a defendant acts up in a courtroom, he can be expelled and he can watch the proceeding on TV, right?
Correct, Judge.
So did the lawyers for the other defendants ask for that relief?
Judge, I don't believe they asked for that specific form of relief, no.
Well, why not?
I don't know, Your Honor. I can't answer that.
It's too late now, right?
So, well, I don't agree, Judge, because on this particular issue there were three...
That's the thing you do with this person. You don't get a severance by acting up in court, right?
Well, I think severance...
Well, no, you don't. We can't permit that, right? We can't permit someone who'd like to be tried by himself to get his trial by himself by acting up. So if he acts up, he's expelled from the courtroom and he watches the case from the cell on a TV screen. And if his disruptions are causing problems to the defendant's lawyer should say, get this guy out of here.
Judge, I don't know whether that was done. I don't think it was done. I don't think it was Calabrese's severance motion. It was the co-defendant's severance motion.
I'm not talking about, look, severance motion is not a proper remedy for someone who acts up.
Okay, well, what is, Judge, I think is what happened in the case that you sat on in Manny, which is that a new trial is warranted under circumstances like this. And if I could add, I see my lights are going, I would just like to add, there were three other jurors who had indicated to the foreperson that they had seen the same threat from Calabrese to the prosecutor. And those three jurors as well should have been questioned. They should have been voir dired, at least by the court, in a private setting. It never happened. And that happened repeatedly.
If you say that Calabrese was acting up throughout the trial, which would be, I would think, disadvantageous to the other defendants. Apparently their lawyers didn't do anything about it.
Well, Judge, I know they did move for severance. It's spread
of
record.
That's not the proper remedy,
okay.
Right?
Well,
you don't earn a severance by misbehaving in court.
Judge, they also moved for mistrial as well. So, I mean, they were...
That's not the correct remedy either,
they
right?
were doing... Well, Judge, I'm stuck by the record. This is what they did request, and they were dealing with a very unusual situation.
I fight to complain about it. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Lapone. Mr. Martin?
Good morning. May it please the Court. The prosecution of James Marcello was deja vu. Envision deja vu.
Deja vu.
And the trial was deja vu all over again. Envision the charge in this case is a circle.
I don't understand. What are you arguing?
The double jeopardy argument, Your Honor. That's what I like to focus on. Completely included within the charge in this case was a charge brought in a prior case, RICO conspiracy. Completely included within the charge in this case was the time period which was prosecuted.
Well, can't you have two conspiracies? Can't you have a small conspiracy embedded in the larger conspiracy?
Not if the small conspiracy is included within the larger conspiracy.
I don't understand that. I mean, you have the overarching conspiracy of this, you know, mob, the outfit. You have that, but within that, can't you have the, you know, these semi-autonomous street crews? That those are little conspiracies, but you can be a member of a street crew, and as a member of a street crew, you're a member of the larger organization.
Yeah, the
and they're different, right? There's Only the larger organization can authorize murders. Street crews can't do murders on their own. Doesn't that separate the two levels?
Well, Your Honor, in the Carlisi case, the prior prosecution, the evidence in that case, as well as the charges, went to the outfit as a whole. The evidence in the Carlisi case and in this case showed that in the mid-1980s, Sam Carlisi took over as head of the entire outfit, and that James Marcello was his second in command. And the evidence in the Carlisi case, the prior prosecution, went to the outfit as a whole. It was focused on the Carlisi street crew, but so was this case. This case, both cases contain evidence regarding the outfit as a whole and the Carlisi street crew, and the upshot of that is that the same underlying agreement was at work.
So let me ask you this question. Suppose we were to agree with you that the enterprise is the same now as it was in the two prior cases that have been put before us, but that the agreement that the enterprises are pursuing in the case now before us was an agreement to use murder as an enforcement mechanism, whereas the agreement in the earlier cases was simply, you know, to make a lot of money using the street crew, you know, with whatever businesses they were in, with the loans, with the street taxes, with what have you. Those would be two different agreements, even though conducted by the same enterprise. Is that, in your view, also something covered by double jeopardy?
Well, Your Honor, you have to look at the evidence in a Carlisi case because...
Well, I'm asking you if I mean, this is a conspiracy case.
That's correct.
We have to define what agreement is there so that we can then see whether the things that happened are within the scope of that agreement and who joined the agreement and, you know, all the rest of that conspiracy law. So I'm trying to, right from the outset, look at what agreement is charged, and if it's a different agreement, are they, in fact, two different prosecutions?
If you look at the agreement that was charged, the Carlisi case included conspiracy to commit murder. Leonard Patrick, in a Carlisi case, testified about his own commission of 6 murders. In the Carlisi case, there was evidence that the Carlisi street crew set...
commit murders as a member of the street crew if it's authorized by the... But look, A corporation has many different contracts, right?
Many different contracts, yes.
And this, you know, this Chicago mob, this corporation of sorts, that has a lot of different contracts, right? Different agreements.
Well, Your Honor, you have to look at the charge here. For double jeopardy purposes, the question is, was the same statutory offense involved? And in this case, the same statutory offense was involved. Then the second question...
You were a member of the mob, and you worked for one street crew, and then you moved over and you worked for another one. Could you be prosecuted for your activities in both of them for conspiracy, or would your position be that it was the same conspiracy? It was the overarching outfit.
Well, I quite honestly would need more details as to that. I suppose you could prosecute.
What details would you like? I suppose you're in one street crew and you do loan sharking and so on, but then it gets too hot for you in that neighborhood, so you leave that. You're reassigned to another street crew and you do your loan sharking and so forth. And can't you be prosecuted as a participant in two conspiracies, even though in both cases you were part of a larger conspiracy?
Your Honor, that situation is different than what we have in this case.
What's your answer to my case?
I will answer yes, because they would be parallel conspiracies. While in this case we had a greater conspiracy that included the lesser conspiracy.
It always includes the lesser, right? I mean, the street crews are authorized by and supervised by the bosses of the overarching conspiracy.
And if there was no evidence of the boss and the outfit as a whole, in the history, in the structure of the outfit, in its division, in interactions between crew, in a Carlisi case, I would agree with you. But that evidence all came in the Carlisi case, because Carlisi took over as the boss. Marcello was supposed to be second in command. And it wasn't just the activities of the Carlisi case that was at issue in that case, but there was evidence how Carlisi used other street crew members to carry out this murder plot and to carry out juice loans and carry out other activities. So there was the interaction of other street crews from the perspective of the outfit as a whole in the Carlisi case.
So what's more important, what the indictment says in the Carlisi case or what evidence came in at trial?
What evidence came in at trial? Because you have to, for double jeopardy purposes, you have to look at the statute. And the statute is simply a conspiracy, an agreement to conduct the affairs of the enterprise by a pattern of racketeering activity. Those are awfully broad elements. And in the Carlisi case, the government went beyond arguing that this is just about the Carlisi street crew and emphasized Carlisi was the boss of bosses and he used other crews and Marcello was the man who got the people together. But let me give you an example by way of the proof, the surveillance evidence. The government in this case called out the...
This case means the Carlisi case, the earlier case?
No, in this case. What the government did was it produced identical surveillance evidence during the 1980s of Mr. Marcello. The same agents who testified in Carlisi testified in this case. The same exhibits, the same photographs.
Are you saying that overlapping evidence creates double jeopardy?
For either double jeopardy is violating...
It's very common when you deal with someone who has a long history of criminal activity.
Double jeopardy is either violated or it is not. I would respectfully suggest that...
I don't know what that means.
Well, for instance,
I'm asking you, does overlapping evidence automatically create a double jeopardy problem?
Not if there's different offenses charged. But in this case, there were not different offenses charged. There were both RICO conspiracy during the same time period. And the question really is whether that overlapping evidence shows the same agreement. And our position is that this was the same agreement that was prosecuted at least during the Carlisi time period. And the Carlisi street crew, when you look at multiple conspiracies, you look at whether the second conspiracy was completely distinct and independent of the other conspiracy.
And
I think they have to be completely distinct.
Well, for multiple conspiracy purposes, the jury was instructed in this case that there had to be this distinction. And obviously they rejected that instruction. They did not find multiple conspiracies. But the question is, was the Carlisi street crew dependent upon the outfit as a whole for its success? The answer to that obviously is yes. But on top of that, I can't stress enough that in the prior case, it dealt with the outfit as a whole.
Now, the government argues, I mean, I think of this as a donut, basically, that the outer rim of the donut is the outfit, and the hole is the Carlisi street crew. So it's inside the outer rim. But the government says we didn't use evidence in this later prosecution. I'll just call it the outfit prosecution as opposed to the Carlisi prosecution. That we used before. We emphasized the murders, for example, and the particular murders that they emphasized in the outfit case that we're now here for didn't come up in the Carlisi prosecution, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so then, looking at our earlier opinion, the other thing that I understand the government to be saying is that we said at some point the evidence would overlap so much that you would lose the sense of distinct arrangements, but that's going to be a question of degree, and the government, of course, argues that the evidence was different enough, even though there may have been some overlapping evidence, that it satisfied the criteria that the majority had set out.
Your Honor, I look at this not as a donut, but as a Bismarck, and it's a circle.
It's
a Bismarck, like a Bismarck donut. You go to Dunkin' Donuts and...
But I don't know what it is.
It has the jelly inside.
Okay.
It's just one big circle, just if you're going to use a donut analogy. With respect to the
you can say that Judge Posner's not a donut either.
I've learned something.
In Milwaukee, we call those punchkis.
Punchkis, yes. With respect to the murder evidence, as I said... there was murder evidence introduced in Carlisi, but this is an instance of the government obtaining broader evidence after a conviction and then rebringing a charge. What happened was that Mr. Calabrese had cooperated, and that supplied him the evidence of the murders. At the time of the Carlisi prosecution, the government had evidence connecting Mr. Marcello allegedly to the Spilotro homicides, but it didn't bring that out. It held that in the background and waited for this case. Murder itself is a red herring. It's not an essential element of RICO conspiracy. The jury was not required to find Mr. Marcello guilty of committing any murder, and the focus must be on the agreement. Was the agreement the same?
How about the predicate acts? Do they need to be the same, too, or different? Or does it not matter, in your view?
In my view, you do have to look to the predicate acts, but what's important is the agreement to commit a pattern of racketeering activity. There doesn't have to be a perfect overlap. That much is made clear by the Bassiano case, which has come down since this court's original opinion. And in that case, there was not complete overlap. There was not mutuality of predicate acts in two substantive RICO conspiracy prosecutions, and the court found a double jeopardy violation. And the reason why the court found a double jeopardy violation was it focused on the predicate, this broad element. And it said it's not the individual predicates that matter, it's the pattern that matters. Is it the same type of pattern? And that's what we have in this case, and it's even one step removed from Bassiano, because that was substantive RICO, and because the focus here has to be on the agreement. And in this case, I would respectfully submit that the government indicated that it would prove multiple conspiracies in a prior appeal. That it did not do. There was substantial overlapping evidence, which we have detailed in the brief. And in the overlapping evidence, one thing that's important about it is it went to the outfit as a whole. For instance, the surveillance evidence. This was not the Carlisi street crew members doing their own thing, their own little agreement. This was Carlisi and Marcello meeting with other top echelon members, other organized crime figures that were not within their street crew. And it was the exact same evidence, the exact same testimony, the exact same exhibits that were admitted. And, I mean, what does this mean? When they're doing it, they're committing two agreements at the same time? That I don't understand. I see that my light is on for rebuttal, so I reserve the rest of my time. The court, please.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All Ms. Christensen?